Welcome to the final episode of Series 3 of the We Society podcast. But today, we're in the rolling Gloucestershire countryside for something a little different, yet still true to what the We Society is all about. Our guest is one of Britain's most celebrated novelists and storytellers, Ian McEwan, whose canon of work has won him the Shakespeare Medal, the Europa Prize, in 2020, the Goethe Medal, and just this month, he was awarded the Commandeur des Arts et Lettres. Developing great narratives should not be the preserve of great fiction, argues Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Schiller. If social scientists want to explain themselves to a wider world, they need to develop the art of the compelling master narrative and use it to get their ideas across. Ian McEwan is such a master. His latest novel, Lessons, is, in my view, a masterwork. But the arc of an indicative liberal's life in post-war Britain, the subject of Lessons, is but one of his many preoccupations. They include biology, computer science, neuroscience, journalism, even social science. His common theme is truth and evidence-seeking, all throwing up troublesome moral choices and the overwhelming emotions they trigger. The stuff of great novels. Ian McEwan, it's brilliant that you've given up the time.
Thank you, Will. I can't think of anything nicer on a warm Sunday afternoon than to be talking with you.
When we said what I said, join the We Society podcast, you heard this kind of slightly kind of idiosyncratic title, The We Society. What are you going to make of it?
Yeah, I thought it might be the Zamyatin Appreciation Society after his great novel. But anyway, we rather than them or us. We, yeah.
You
collective,
like
yeah, tolerant, generous, inclusive, us, we.
Precisely. Actually, I interviewed Ai Weiwei, the Chinese dissident, and he pointed out that there's that conception of we, but in China there's a very different conception of we, oppressive.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, like the word people, which you might think just refers to everyone you know and everyone you see in the street, but when the people have decided and you find yourself in prison for writing an awkward book or an awkward piece of journalism, then the people becomes a very barbed and rather odious concept.
A censorship or any sense that you might be curtailed or constrained in what you write, has that ever crossed your kind of consciousness?
Early on in my career, I got a television play banned, but that was because of its sexual content rather than anything political. And many years later, I think about 25 years later, it was shown on television and no one even noticed.
Times move on.
Yeah, so not everything's getting worse. Generally and relatively, compared to many, many other countries, and they're on the increase, this has been a free and open society to write novels in.
Now, Lessons is the kind of arc of a life. The character, Roland, is, I think, the same age as you, Ian.
Isn't that odd?
And the reason I liked it so much was it this kind of interface between the kind of indecisions and anguishes of a liberal intersecting with major, major national and global events, even kicking off with losing his virginity to his music teacher because the world might be blown up with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And how much does it refract your own experience, your own sense of kind of a helpless liberalism or a feeble liberalism interacting with events beyond our control?
Well, I think that just as certain songs can form the soundtrack for our existence, so do international crises or national crises. They become part of who we are and what we are. And even for people who take no interest in the news and don't read newspapers, they will be shaped by it, I think, by a certain kind of optimism, pessimism in the air, that spectrum. Times when you feel that you're living in an era of possibility, and other times when you think we're all going to hell in a handcart. I think a good index of whether culture, the political world, can judge itself is, do we think our children are going to have a better life or more opportunities than we did? At the moment, I would say, I feel, speaking as a 68er, as it were, that generation, and who lived in an expanded set of opportunities from the state. I was state educated all the way through. That it's a lot harder for a young person now than it was then. Even contemplating things like rents. If you were a young writer in 1972 in London, like me, like I was, my rent was £24 a month for a three-bedroom place in South London. And although I was living on £500 a year, I felt I had everything I needed. Enough in the way of paperbacks or library books, enough to eat and drink. We didn't have many machines to run. And education was free. University education was free. Admittedly, only 6% of us went. And I think that is an important consideration. But generally, you know, it was the Augustan age of rock and roll and paperback books and possibility. And that seems to have narrowed. It seems to have shrunk. The world seemed to have both got filled with more people and shrunk at the same time.
The price of a chicken in the supermarket was the same, had gone up by the same rate as a house price from you were in 1972. A price for chicken would now be £50.
It would taste a lot better because it's a transactional matter. People who are tested on wine, if they're told it costs £50 a bottle, really enjoy it. So, yeah, chicken would have tasted a lot better, Will. But apart from that, yeah.
There's a sense of this
buying
in
your own house is not possible.
There's this in your novel where you say, there's a great, I have to, it's such a great line that I just have to read it to you. I just, because you're actually kind of talking about, it's my generation as much as your generation. You talk about us, what's it, yes, lolled on history's aproned lap, nestling in a little fold of time, eating all the cream.
Yes.
Our generation.
We're the cats who got the cream. And, you know, for those who can help their children buy a house or even rent a house, it's one thing, but I think that's a minority. There's a whole generation now who have no hope of ever buying a house. I mean, even if they're in employment in a, you know, £35,000 a year job, there's no chance. It's just not possible. But coming back to your original question, part of the first thought I had about this novel was to write a list of international events that impacted my own life. And the very first one was the Suez Crisis. But I was only 8 years old. I understood absolutely nothing about it. I just found myself bundled into an army camp. I was living in Libya. My dad was a soldier, an officer.
Which, of course, Roland does as well.
Yeah, so I gave all this to Roland as his first experience of an international event. My mother, by a stroke of incredible fortune, was in England. My father was way too busy. I saw him in the distance striding around with a revolver strapped to his waist. And so myself and a handful of school friends just lived a life that was so free that I'd never touched on before. So the Suez Crisis for me was, I mean, not what the Suez Crisis was if you were at Sèvres for the secret meeting, you know, with the French. But it gave me a taste of freedom that never really left me. And I think now, in retrospect, many years contemplating this, it was one element that pushed me towards wanting to be a writer and never have a job. Just this taste of, for example, hanging out in the machine gun nests with the soldiers who thought there was going to be a nationalist uprising in Libya, which is why all civilians were herded into camps. Being given rides on a Harley Davidson by, you know, spirited young officers, hanging around in the tank workshops, playing football on a grassless, sandy football pitch covered in oil to keep the sand down. Smell of oil and sand, I think, would be a wonderful, yeah, if you're stuck for a Christmas present for me, a kind of aftershave, the smell of oil and sand, I'd be dousing myself in it. It'd be the smell of freedom. But then the Cuba Missile Crisis.
I watched it blow by blow and thinking, God, yeah, the world might end. Yeah.
The curious thing about the Cuba Missile Crisis, when civilization could have been obliterated, is that it never really lodged in the public imagination the way the Kennedy assassination did. It doesn't come up in an old way. And one writer said, it's almost as if we had lifted a stone and seen some unspeakable creatures underneath it and just replaced the stone and hurried on because it was too awful to contemplate and too stupid to contemplate.
And now?
Now
we have China squaring up to the US, or the US squaring up to China. I mean,
And we might die for Taiwan democracy.
Is that part of your sense that horizons are closing? That you and I grew up in a sense of there was opportunity. It seemed unbounded. We could talk the language of love and revolution. And it all seemed possible. In 2023, you could not say that.
Yes, and there's all kinds of things you cannot say around the world. So in the period of optimism, which I count as sort of post-fall of Berlin Wall, democracies were increasing, Freedom House and like-minded institutes were counting up the numbers, and it wasn't just Central Europe that was beginning to be free, but countries in South America. Spain and Portugal had earlier gone that way. And there was, and South Africa, of course, the end of apartheid, there was a real sense of possibility. And in 1972, for example, in my own life, and this is why these big things also are personal things, I went to Amsterdam with a couple of American friends. We bought a bit of a jalopy and drove it to Peshawar, crossing Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Fascinating and extraordinary journey. We were free. And one of the things I thought when I stood in no man's land, having gone through the west side of the wall, was broken open, we all went into no man's land from Potsdamer Platz. I was thinking, you know, I think I might be able to repeat that journey and drive to the Bering Straits from Calais. Maybe in 5 or 10 years' time. Maybe there was a tiny window when that was possible and I didn't notice it. It came and went. There are places now where I'd be very reluctant to go. If you speak openly about, for example, your atheism or doubts about religion or scepticism about it, there are many countries where, from Bangladesh to Pakistan and many others, where you would be really foolish to speak your mind, speak freely. So places you can't go because you can't speak freely. I think now Russia and China have to be included. That's a big part of the world. Muslim majority countries plus China, plus Russia, and Saudi Arabia certainly included in that. And weirdly enough, Will, in the West where we have these freedoms, we seem to be closing those off too. And, last year I signed a letter in support of Joanna Rowling for, she's death threats. Well, how extraordinary. It started with a tweet she wrote about a clean water charity, a very worthy organisation, but in its rubric, it was falling over backwards to avoid the word women, as in men, women and children, access to clean water. And she said, well, what was that word? Was it Wombles or Wimbledons or Wambons? And it was a piece of perfectly, harmless teasing of a protest. You can't remove this word from the vocabulary. Look what happened. Look what happened. This is just one small case. And it's a case of a very wealthy woman whose life can certainly flourish. So we're in danger of, taking away this gift and doing it willfully among ourselves. Things that can't be said. And in the States, it's just gone nuts. Completely nuts.
Come back. You wrote Machines Like Me. And it was kind of before the current controversies about artificial intelligence. I mean, in a sense, you were ahead of the curve. And I just wondered, I cited in my introduction Robert Shiller,
yeah,
who talks about kind of having a vision, and social scientists should have a vision if they want to get their ideas over. And a couple of great economists say, who published a book just kind of Power and Progress, Darren Acemoglu and Simon Johnson, and they say all technology is malleable. You can, you know, AI could be used for bad things, like the Chinese are going to use it, or it could be used for good things, kind of medical diagnosis. But you have a vision, a great, you know, here you are, you're a great narrative teller, great kind of novelist of our generation, you know. Do you have a vision for how we might use AI?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree. It's a human thing, and the human uses it's put to, and the human control it has will determine, you know, how we're going to feel about it. Again, I think in binary terms, let's say China and the West, there's the problem of state control of it in China, and there's a problem here of commercial control of it.
Exactly.
And that is the division we have. So there must be, certainly in the West, some kind of Wikipedia, as it were, an old-fashioned early internet romanticism that we have to return to, where we're in a collective. It needs to be constrained by legislation that has a firm grip of what those values are of openness and fairness and inclusiveness, of who has access to this and what's done with it. And we're only at the very, very early stages. We've hardly got our toes in the water, ChatGPT and so on, and the fourth iteration of OpenAI's software. Most of us, as has been the case now for a couple of centuries, are like, you know, innocent children in a forest of giant redwoods. I mean, our understanding, most of us could not tell you how a two-way electric switch works, let alone. So, you know, it all seems to be a miracle, by the way, that when I turn a light on at the other end of the hall. But that requires a vision. And I heard a conversation you did about, you know, six things you love that aren't very well known about. I immediately thought, even before you started speaking, well, that's going to be six things that we'll no longer love because everyone knows about them. But anyway, you said something right at the end about a clause 172 or something of the responsibility put on businesses that seemed, you know, far-reaching.
Section 172.
Yeah.
Of the 2005 Companies Act.
Marvellous.
Yes.
I didn't know about it, and I thought...
Actually, you're
Let's
right.
translate that vision to a notion of what AI can be. And it needs that kind of statement, firm grip of what an open society is, for example. And you see its failure. We saw it last week, you know, with policemen rounding up and arresting people who have got a different view on the role of the monarchy.
The law around it, any consequences?
Yeah.
The membership of a republic has doubled since then.
I know. Yeah, it's gone from 2,000 to 4,000 or something. But yes, it's doubled. But it does need... And the trouble is, I mean, I don't feel it's in the air at the moment. It needs values. And those values need to be generally agreed. And I thought the spirit of those values was in your 172.
It is. Actually, you've really got... One of the things that... these two economists that I quoted.
Maybe you should just tell what's in 172, because it...
Yes, I should do that.
In two sentences.
Section 172 actually came out of the state we're in, which I wrote nearly 30 years ago. And
I read it in TypeScript.
and you gave it an endorsement. Thank you. But the it simply says that actually the responsibility of the directors of a company is much bigger and larger than the promotion of the share price and immediate short-term profits. You have a duty of care to your employees, to your customers, to your stakeholders, and to the wider society. This doesn't have the force of law, or even that it is part of the Companies Act, and there's been big debates about to what extent it should be legally supplant the notion that all a director has to do is to maximise a share price. But it is there.
Yeah.
Suppose
you transferred all that, those duty of care,
AI,
to users of AI.
You would have, it would be devastating.
Yeah.
It would be really devastating.
So it would have to come out of the hands of commercial interests. I mean, they could still run it and make profit on it, but they would have to be in the law. It would need enforceability. In other words, if you suddenly thought, AI, this kind of open AI stuff, marvellous opportunities for pornography or whatever, well, that doesn't serve everyone in the ways that 172 does. So I thought you had answered your own question by proposing to me or teaching me something I had never heard of, the idea that a business is a social entity and is rooted in our collective sense of selves and has a responsibility to all those around it and not just the shareholders, is something deeply applicable to how we approach AI. We're heading towards, I mean, let's suppose we had it, even at the best, we still would have this binary conflict between state-controlled AI in China. And they've worked very hard. They probably have maybe 150,000 people now working on censoring just the old-fashioned internet.
Well, it's beyond Orwellian Big Brother. I mean, you can this social control where, you know, if you even, you know, jaywalk, a message will come from party HQ or from the kind of central authority on your mobile telling you what you've offended. You've now lost. You've now got 3 points. And if you do it again, you're going to have 6 points and you'll lose your license to walk about. And you'll be
or
able to
get a mortgage or whatever.
It's extraordinary. I mean, and of course, that in a way is what this coming argument, fight, war in Taiwan, if it ever comes to that, will ultimately be about.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I can imagine the voters in Detroit saying, I don't want to die for 28 million Taiwanese. And they might vote accordingly, and we still are faced with the spectre of Trump.
Do you think your values and the values you and I share are indivisible? I mean, you've won the Goethe Medal. You're about to get the Commandeur des Arts et Lettres. You know, that's France and Germany speaking. I mean, that's European values. But, I mean, do you think the UN Declaration of Human Rights has got Enlightenment values, yeah, but are they universal? I mean, the Chinese would say, well, no, we have another value system which we're trying to promote the greater good of the greatest number, yeah, in Benthamite terms, for 1.4 billion people. Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah. Well, odd though that you have to lock people up to do that. largely, I think, is to keep the Communist Party of China in place, less about the 1.4 billion. It's perfectly possible to spread opportunity and wealth without locking people up, without locking up journalists and poets and novelists and scientists and people who speak out, or citizens who speak out. So,
Do you feel a personal, as a writer, have you felt a responsibility, in a sense, to the world of letters to speak out when you see arrests, when you see kind of cancel culture, when you see... the fat warrant against Salman Rushdie, as I know, is a friend of yours. I mean...
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on that with him. I sign letters, I send money. I'm not, by many other standards, an activist, because I'm also sort of protecting this world in which it's the only way I can write a novel. I can't go on... I mean, I'm constantly invited to go and speak at this and that, but I need the privacy and quiet to devise the structure of a fiction. I can't do it and be on the road for the 1,000 very good causes that are going. So that balance has been a constant feature in my life. I really care about this or that. But then do I want to fly to Lisbon and say so when, for a start, I don't think it's going to make much difference, but also... my central concern, and has been for 50 years, is to write fiction.
Where do you get the ideas from? And one of the things I'm always struck by, I mean, when you wrote Saturday, you shadowed a neuro surgeon, and you actually kind of wanted to go and watch him operate and actually put your hand on someone's brain.
Just a finger.
A finger, okay. All right, well, I mean, okay. It gets
the bone
better.
Flap is quite small. Well,
okay. Nonetheless, not everyone has put a finger on a person's
brain.
They
have to take a lot more skull off to get a hand in there.
And you came and shadowed me when I was editor of The Observer.
That's right.
That's not what every novelist does. Why does every novelist do that?
I've done it for a bit, actually. I don't know whether getting older makes you just more reflective and think, actually, I've got loads more material just sitting in my head.
Where does that come from? The radio, television, lived experience? How does it come?
Well, in those instances you just mentioned there, there was a long period of time when I was interested in other people's work. And I thought that what people did to earn a living was strangely missing from the modern novel. That identity is caught up with there, means, education, I mean, there's a sense of self, everything about a character. And I've always been interested in character, the delineation of character in fiction. Because writers are generally either teachers or freelancers living at home, working from home, their characters are often rather cut off from the world of what people do 9 to 5 or 8 till 10, as in the case of Neurosurgeons. And I love, maybe it was all my first experiences of film sets, I love other people's expertise in things. I love learning the sort of small vocabulary that protects, as it were, an in-group of people who are collaborating on something. So it was very natural for me to go and spend time in the National Hospital, watching operations, scrubbing up with the guys in the morning, being horrified by the state of the changing room. I mean, can you imagine it? These are neurosurgeons, and on the laboratory door it said, for the 10th time, will you please lift the seat while urinating? These are guys who can have their hands in your brain. You think, my God. But details like that are irresistible. These are not gods. They have feet of, well, and other parts of clay. And I've spent time in solar laboratories and, yeah, came to one of your news conferences, sat in a BBC news conference for radio when I was writing Plowman's Lunch. I'm interested in the realist novel. I mean, that's what most of my fiction has been, with one or two sort of breakouts from it. Depicting the reality that we all can name and share is a matter of huge artifice, and getting it right is important. And it can only be done by highly selective detail, and finding those details, you have to go and look for them. You have to go and be there and sit and brew with them. Having seen them, you've got to cogitate, which is why I can't fly off to, all over the world to go and protest about something.
But science and social science, and this is the Academy of Social Sciences doing this podcast, everything about us is an attempt to marshal evidence and on the base of evidence kind of say something illuminating about the world. And in a way, you're saying that your craft as a novelist is kind of first cousin to that.
Yeah. I'm interested. These are the kind of novels I like to read as well as write. Quite drawn to the novel that tells us something about what it is to be a person in these conditions of modernity now, early stages of the 21st century. I'm writing, or trying to write at the moment, a novel based on the premise that the humanities, for all the turmoil and catastrophes that the world have gone through in the next 4 or 5 centuries, so this is the 26th century, that it survived. What will survive of us is poetry. What will survive of us are English literature studies. So this is trying to see the 21st century, which is the period that my hero, my narrator, specializes in, through the lens of, or 10 lenses, as it were, of a fairly remote future. most science fiction is based on the idea that it's like, like Dune. You know, we're all living in a desert and all crouching around a peat fire, remembering, how our great-great-great-grandfathers could stand under a stream of hot water in February and douse ourselves in luminous liquids to make our hair shiny. No one believes that anymore. No, what about someone in a rather seedy, run-down humanities department in a university in the year 2560 trying to write a book about a completely invented poet of our time, sort of equal of Seamus Heaney? I've read biographies of, written and now, say, of 16th century poets that get right inside their love life, right inside their communications. People try it with Shakespeare, it's rather difficult. It's not much private stuff about him. What happens when you have at your disposal the 87,500 emails that your subject of study sent in a lifetime?
You have to have artificial intelligence to sort it out.
Yes, you need really good search engines because you're never going to be able to read them all yourself. So although people bemoan the fact that people no longer write long letters to each other and, like Dickens, like Darwin, like Napoleon for that matter, we will have maybe 100,000 emails that they sent or 200,000 that they sent with the minute details that novelists who are interested in social realism like me will have a feast on.
So you think it's going to be more fun to be a novelist in 2560 than today?
The material is just going to be like a mountain range. Because you'll have, let's say, also 6 centuries of movie making, 6 centuries of novel writing, 6 centuries of journalism. And it's all there, retrievable. And let's say all the private encrypted communication that's on, say, WhatsApp, all stripped open by AI and by quantum computing and advanced, traveling salesman problems.
So you don't find this world dystopian? It doesn't frighten you? You think freedoms will be preserved in this world?
Well, I'm just postulating how the realist novel has a future.
We're reaching the end. I just want to ask you, I just want to read back that quote from Lessons. Our generation, lolled on history's aproned lap, nesting in a little fold of time, eating all the cream. It's kind of Shakespearean.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is two iambic pentameters, I know you say.
Where do those words come from? How does it happen that you write stuff like that? I mean, it's magical.
Well, I wrote a similar sentence in... maybe it was Amsterdam. I can't remember, but I've often thought of our privileges. I mean, my parents left school at 14. My father got a scholarship to grammar school, but he couldn't take it up because his family wanted him to go out to work. It's a very, very common story. I was born in 1948. I had all the opportunities of a much enhanced primary school education, even though it's sort of run by the British Army in North Africa. All its goals were the same as back in England.
But you're on your laptop or your PC, and these words come out. I mean, what's actually happening? What's the alchemy inside your head that delivers it?
I don't know, because that's almost a question for neuroscience. I don't know what's happening, but when you sit quietly and try and lasso the sense of meaning you have in your head with the words, and it often fails. It's rather like if you could think of a tune in your head, but you go to whistle it, it just vanishes. The gap between thinking of something and finding the words for it is a precipice. It's something to leap across. That's why you need silence and exile and cunning.
Are you an optimist or a pessimist, finally?
Well, I think my sort of automatic daytime grumpy 75-year-old almost self is pessimist. But when I reflect on the need for never giving up on the possibilities of progress, which is a much discarded and ridiculed notion, especially in academia, then I think that life would be futile if we don't think that we could do things better than we are doing them now. So my optimism really hangs in that consideration.
So you're a progressive in a sense that you believe in progress, broadly defined.
Well, broadly defined, you know, in terms of openness in a society and distribution of opportunities, and possibly even some wealth. Yes. Well, I mean, you yourself have dedicated a lifetime to positing better economic ways of doing things. I mean, better ways of doing things in economics.
I'm still trying, Ian. I'm still trying.
You're trying. Yeah, well, behind that must lie a sense that it's achievable.
It is achievable.
It is perfectly achievable.
I wouldn't be doing this job as President of the Academy of Social Science if I didn't think it was achievable.
And occasionally it pops up and we think, aha, and then it gets forgotten or washed away by events or some countermeasures, and principally by vested interests. And if one has, well, I mean, this is sounds a bit corny, but I have to say that if one has children and grandchildren, as I do, it almost becomes beyond reason and a matter of faith that the world could be better for them. And we all have our responsibilities towards that.
I'm dedicating my next book to my grandchildren.
Are you? Good. You'll never know if they read it. That's the good thing about dedicating your mentor.
Thank you so much. My God, we've covered ground from your boyhood in the Libyan sands through arguments about tolerance, through opening up artificial intelligence through
172.
Section 172 of the Companies Act. Yeah,
you must start the 172 movement.
The 172. and rounding off with a, you know, optimism about progress, partly because we're condemned as grandfathers to believe in progress.
Yeah.
But it's been great. Thank you so much. And thank you for being on the We Society.
It's been a real pleasure and fun.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.